Good evening and welcome to the Town and Discovery Day, a special workshop this evening. At this time, if I could have everybody stand for the Pledge of Allegiance.
I pledge allegiance to the flag of the United States of America and to the republic for which it stands, one nation, under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all.
President Steele?
Here.
Vice President Pease?
Here.
Director Graves?
Here.
Director Lee?
Here.
Director Simon?
Here.
Thank you very much. At this time, we'll have public comments. Public comments will be limited to a three-minute time limit. Anybody in the public may comment on any item on the agenda that is before the board for consideration. Any person wishing to speak must come up and speak from the podium at the front of the room. There's going to be no dialogue between the board and the commenter. Any clarifying questions from the board must go through the chair. Is there any public comment?
Is there any public?
All right, no public comment. I'll move forward.
She's a reporter.
Say something. Come on, Heather, get up and say something.
She'll write about it on Friday.
Oh, yeah, you'll hear from me later.
We'll move on to item C, workshop item, financing strategies for the Regional Water Quality Control Board mandated projects. Staff, please.
Thank you, Mr. President, members of the board. This has been a little difficult in scheduling all of us together along with the consultant. But thank you for making time this evening. Saul Rosenbaum is with Prager and Company, and we've met, I think Director Graves met Saul. We met
Monterey
a few years ago, mm-hmm. and Saul has stayed in the picture and has come to me on numerous occasions and asked if we have anything going on and what's on the horizon. And once we realized we had the filtration and the denitrification projects, he and I started talking probably late last year about trying to schedule something before the board. So this evening, Saul's going to be here and he's going to give you an update and a presentation on just what our options are. Not necessarily which direction are we going to go, we have time for that, but just which options do you want to pursue. It's a roundtable discussion, and so that's generally the idea for this evening. You can interject, ask questions at any time. I know he's ready for that. So with that, Saul.
Thank you. Good evening. Thank you for inviting me to be with you for tonight. I'm hoping that I'm close enough to this. Can all hear me okay?
Mm-hmm.
Let me give you a little bit of background about myself. I'm a managing director in principle with a boutique investment bank headquartered in San Francisco called Prager and Company. We provide strategic financial advisory, municipal advisory, fiduciary advisory work for primarily tax-exempt entities throughout the United States, of course, largely in California, and we're also a broker-dealer. In my capacity tonight, if we were to be engaged, if Prager Company were to eventually be engaged, the capacity that we're proposing to offer is to serve as your financial advisor. That is, we would have a fiduciary duty to place the district, federal fiduciary duty, to place the district's interests ahead of our own. That's the distinction between a municipal advisor, a financial advisor, and an underwriter. Rick and I have been discussing the district's projects and strategic financial advice as it relates to the district's projects for on and off for a few years. I think even dating back to 2012 when you did your last bond issue. Although I'm not here in that capacity tonight, it just so happens that I have served as the lead consultant for my firm, the California Special District Association Finance Corporation, since its formation in 1988. In my capacity as CSDA Finance Corporation's consultant over the last 25 years or so, I've worked with, call it, upwards of 100 special districts to help those districts fund upwards of $1 billion of capital improvements for water improvements, sewer improvements, fire district improvements, fire truck acquisitions, library districts, park and recreation districts, the whole smorgasbord independent special district So in terms of the workshop, what Rick asked me to focus on tonight is just what he said, and that is a food for thought discussion. Here am I, a practitioner of over 20 years in public finance, working with municipal entities and special districts in particular in California. As a few extent, I can offer my perspective and expertise in terms of strategies for funding mission-critical capital projects. That's what I'm here to do tonight. So that's the food for thought discussion. He also asked that I consider framing the discussion in terms of, as it relates to future debt capacity and future debt affordability, in terms of your existing debt that you issued in 2012, in terms of your proposed capital improvements that Rick alluded to, and all of that also in terms of your overall financial profile. And then the third thing that Rick asked me to focus on was to frame the discussion and comments in terms of the various mechanisms and alternatives and options that you have for accessing capital. So those are the three things. Again, the food for thought discussion intended to be provocative and to promote discussion, not just for me to pontificate. I really want to do my best to be responsive to your questions and concerns. To frame the discussion in terms of future debt affordability and debt capacity, take into consideration existing debt and your financial profile, and also to frame the discussion in terms of the various mechanisms and options and alternatives you have for accessing capital. So, the way the presentation is laid out is just like I just mentioned, there's three sections. And for me, although I could say altruistically that I do this for years, really in order for me to speak to you knowledgeably, I need to educate myself first on what the district's financial profile and debt profile is. So selfishly I do that, but I also know that it's very helpful to you because you don't do this every day and you don't focus on your debt profile every day. You have a fairly simple debt profile. In 2012, you issued bonds, roughly $13 million or so are currently outstanding of those bonds, and about $12.3 million of those bonds that are outstanding are allocable to your wastewater fund. And as you can see by this chart here, the amount of debt service, annual debt service that's allocable to the wastewater fund or the sewer fund, however you refer to it, is a little over $700,000 a year. Those bonds are tax exempt, fixed rate bonds with a final maturity of 2042, so they're 30-year bonds, and they are callable at 100 cents on the dollar beginning in December 1st, 2022. So this is your current, let's call it your current debt service burden, or your current wastewater fund's debt service burden. You have hard copies in front of you, so it's not so hard for you to read. I apologize to everyone else. This a little bit of fine print up on the screen. But if we're talking about debt affordability and debt capacity, the question is, in what terms, by what measure are we talking about debt affordability and debt capacity? And the simplest and plainest way to think about that is in terms of the district's wastewater fund's income statement, or profit and loss statement, or statement of activities, however you refer to it. So what we have here, this is pretty simple. We've taken the last 2 years of the district's income statement straight off the face of its audited financial statements, and that's 13 and 14. The district's 2015 audited financial statements aren't complete yet, and so we've had to make assumptions with respect to 2015. When they are complete, we'll gladly factor them in. And then 16, 17, 18, and 19 are pro forma projections or forecasts, and I'm going to tell you the assumptions behind the growth rates that we've utilized to forecast your main revenue sources, charges and services, and your main operating expenses, which are contract services. At the bottom of the page, so basically what we have is your operating revenues, your operating expenses, and your operating surplus or loss at the bottom. And then moving on to the next page, just a continuation. We have the non-operating revenues, and then we get to a line item in the middle of the page called revenues available for debt service. The revenues available for debt service is your annual income statement's deficit or surplus, to which we add back depreciation, the non-cash expense, and interest on your existing debt, to get a picture of how much revenue you have available on an annual basis and on an annual projected basis to service your existing debt and any future projected debt. What we're trying to, so that's the revenues available for debt service. Then what we've also done is we've said, okay, we know that you have an existing $13 million of debt, plus or minus, outstanding, and that you're contemplating as much as another $8 million of debt. So what we're trying to get at is, what does your charges for services, what do the rate increases supporting your charges for services, how do they need to adjust in order to comply with your existing financial covenant of 1.2 times on a current and forward looking basis? And that's what we attempted to provide some insight into. Now, you have separately engaged a rate consultant, we understand, to perform a rate study to help you with this. So we're not here to separately parallel or mirror what they have formally been engaged to do. This is just strictly to help inform a discussion and to provide some food for thought, to kind of provoke the thinking around debt affordability and options. So this is an important page, because this lists the assumptions that go into the pro forma income statement that we've crafted here. So what we basically determined is that charges for services, your primary revenue source, would need to grow by 11.4% in the next fiscal year, a rate increase, in order to support your existing debt and your proposed $8 million of additional debt. The other assumptions are important, and you could, I'm happy to read them to you if you'd like me to, but I have them right in front of me. You can read this all yourself. Yeah.
Can I ask you a real quick question? I just wanted to make sure that we're all on the same page. An assumption of 11%, 11.04, that's a one-time, that's not an annual every year thing. That's a one-time adjustment to cover the debt moving forward, correct?
So, no.
I didn't think that either. I thought it was this year, and next year has to be 11%.
Yeah. So, again, this is very preliminary. Remember, I want to keep emphasizing. We don't have the benefit of having your rate study, and we don't have the benefit of having your 2015 audit financial statement or your 2016 budget factored into this. However, this analysis here assumes a year-over-year increase of roughly 11%. Now, this has been a bit of a work in progress today. And so when I got here at when I arrived here a little before 5, I got on the phone with my team back at the office, and I said, 11% year over year is going to provide a lot more than your 1.2 times coverage that's required, and it's going to also provide additional capacity for debt that you may or may not want. What I want to know is, what is a one-time rate increase going to need to be? in order to provide 1.2 times coverage for the next fiscal year. And that number is 19%. It's a much bigger number. The subsequent year is 0.93%, less than 1%. In 2018, it would be 2.7%. And in 2019, it would be 2.54%, let's call it.
So I'll get if those numbers work for this analysis, but is there an opportunity for a Harlow Wells or an investment bank to say, to spread those out evenly as you would spread out debt service payments or anything else? So on an equal basis, you'd be 4% a year for 10 years rather than a lump sum, 11% or 19%.
Well, I think the 11% is the minimum that you need. You can see, if you look at this in 2016, you need that 11% to get that coverage.
If you need 8 million that year.
If you need 8 million.
If you need 4 and 4.
Correct.
If you need 3 and something.
Correct.
You can spread those numbers.
Of course. There's lots of flexibility with
respect to that. I may be getting ahead of the game here, but I'm looking at year fiscal year 17, and I'm looking at current principal payments of 277, interest payments of 461, and that's serving a $13 million debt, correct?
Correct.
And then I'm looking down below, and we have a principal payment of 75 and an interest payment of 363, serving an $8 million debt, which is half, well, two-thirds of the previous debt. Why are the interest payments so high? What's the rate we're talking about for that?
So the rate
currently we're at 3.0
or 4.03.
Is that where
we're at? 4.0.
4.0 on our bond. What kind of an interest rate are we talking about on this?
That's listed in the assumption.
It seems like a lot more. It seems like double what we're paying for, or not quite double, but without my calculator, it's a lot more of a percentage than I'd like it to be.
Yeah.
Is there an assumption of what the interest rate's being used?
You're not moving on yet?
Since need of 8 million.
It doesn't say it.
So the assumption is less than 4%. I can tell you that.
Really?
Director Graves? The assumption is less than 4%.
Hmm? 3.7. Is it a shorter term?
Yeah.
Okay.
I don't believe it's a shorter term. So
interesting.
I would need to dig into that a little deeper. It doesn't seem as quite as off to me as it does to you. but I can dig into that and come back.
Okay.
Come back to
it. It just seems disproportionate to me to look at it just on the face value.
Let me just pull out my handy dandy calculator here. I've had this since I was an analyst at Ernst & Young in 1986.
I remember those.
HP12C. So what I'm doing basically is I'm saying, so the par amount alone is going to be more than $8 million. It's going to be funding a debt service reserve fund as well as paying costs of issuance. So if you need $8 million, let's call it, let's just say $8.6 million.
Okay.
Just for, okay, so you have $8.6 million loan. Is the present value for 30 years. Let's say the interest rate is
3.8.
So what would the annual debt service be? $467,000 a year.
Well, we were at 7.
And my HPWM block.
It's like another million or so capital, but then your OEMs.
That's the same as we're paying for. That's 4.0.
That's principal and interest.
Oh,
principal and
interest. Okay, all right.
Yeah.
Very good.
Principal.
Okay. Can we isolate the interest payment out of that? Is your calculator that good?
It is, but I'm not. Well, I can tell you though. I mean, the assumptions that we're using was an interest rate of 3.8%.
We do the filters.
That's based on the same.
Right. I said I'm probably a little bit ahead of the game, but I started looking at the numbers, and it screws me up when I do that. And everybody else.
I did have a question towards Bob's question. If you're going to issue bonds, you have to cover the debt at the beginning of the bond period. And they won't issue bonds, I don't believe, you can answer this one. But I don't think they're going to issue bonds on the come that when you'll raise rates down the load after the bonds are issued, right?
Correct.
So, what,
correct.
So you know, if you guys are going for $8 billion, you got to hit the 1.20 from day one, and they're going to want to see that 1.20 is the whole way from day one. So you don't have the option of saying, well, we're going to go with annual rate increases all the way into it, unless you're going to split the bond,
separate that was my point.
Sales the of the bonds going down. So you have to split it in like four and then have a second issue of four. But the other problem is you're going to hire a contractor, and build it all at once. And you can't, as an agency, go issue a contract. The contractor, if you don't have the funds
for,
to pay for it. So it's going to be a tight trap to split it because it's all going down on one project on one contractor. You know what I'm saying? And so you won't be able to advertise if you can't afford the project. You won't be able to start the project until the gates. You don't have funding in place. And you can't get all the funding unless you get debt coverage at 1.2 at the beginning.
When we, just for historical purposes, when we did the 2012 enterprise revenue bonds, the board took a very bold stance and in back-to-back years raised rates by 35% and 28%, just so that the revenues were there for when the bill came in. So that was just the, that was just the historical.
We were able to flatten it out after that.
Flatten back out. It was two big years, and then it's flattened right back out to 3.5%.
In response to your question, I'm hesitant to respond in terms of absolutes as to what investors in the market will accept at any particular day or month. However, I would agree with you. Or I would offer that I think that it is most prudent to have a rate structure in place that indicates that you can satisfy your rate cut rate from the start. Okay. So then, so this is dense. I realize it's a lot to consider and gives us a lot of fodder for discussion. We should come back to this, or this is going to be a very short presentation. But the other area that that Rick asked me to focus on are the options for accessing capital. Since the global financial crisis commenced in 2007, the landscape for accessing capital, as you may or may not know, has changed pretty dramatically from both a competitive and a regulatory standpoint. I'm sure you've heard reference to terms such as Dodd-Frank and the consumer financial protections and whatnot. And there have been, as a result of those and the fact that interest rates are extremely low, banks have become a much more significant player and lender, and in many cases replacing or supplanting what would otherwise have just been what otherwise would have been basically the only option for you would have been to access the tax-exempt capital markets through a public offering. So your last offering was a public offering, and a direct placement with a bank is a private placement. And I can get into the nuances of the differences between a private placement and a public offering. I can answer any questions you may have with respect to that. I think the most important thing to keep in mind is that we say this somewhere. We say that assuming that alternative debt funding options possess equivalent cost of capital, terms, and covenants, that the district, financially speaking, economically speaking, is indifferent to whether you do a public offering or a private placement. What you want are the best terms and conditions possible.
And the good news is with banks having entering the market and being more active, and who knows how long that's gonna last, because they have all of their own regulatory and competitive pressures, and I believe we're on the cusp of a, let me put it another way, we're supposed to believe that we're on the cusp of the Federal Reserve increasing rates, and what that's gonna do to banks' appetites for lending and their net interest margins, all that stuff, is anybody's guess. But the bottom line is, you're looking to fund mission-critical capital projects at the lowest risk-adjusted cost of capital possible. I think that's what's key to remember. Okay, so this is just simply a graphical depiction of pretty simple of what your annual debt service on a amount of $8 million would look like. And then what we've done here is we've just made some assumptions. The most important assumptions that we've made, although we've depicted it in terms of what this would look like as a public offering, as a private placement, you can see that they're very similar in terms of the annual interest charge. Now, maybe the covenants in terms of conditions would be significantly different. You certainly want to explore them. As a sheer financial matter, the rates are looking very similar. The important assumption here is that we're assuming that we are wrapping the proposed debt service around your existing debt service. So, as you know, you could simply say, well, why are we doing that? Let's just amortize the new loan over 30 years and just paste it on top of our existing debt service, and that's okay. However, you might also say, you know, interest rates are really low, and given how low they are, we're not really being compensated or rewarded for retiring principal early. And because the markets aren't compensating us, they would be compensating you if interest rates were, you know, and some of you do too, you know, it wasn't all that long ago that short-term interest rates were 18% back in 82, but I certainly remember in 88, short-term rates were 8.75%. But the point being is, when rates are high, you are clearly being rewarded and compensated for amortizing principal faster rather than slower. With interest rates as low as they are, the question is, well, shoot, maybe we do want to amortize, wrap our proposed principal around our existing principal such that we stretch out the repayment of our principal. And the benefit of that is that we're able to do that at a relatively low rate, and we get a certain amount of budgetary relief from doing that as well. The additional budgetary burden of simply structuring a new loan such that it's level, the debt service is level over the life of the loan, and putting that on top of your 2012 loan is going to have a higher budgetary impact than what we call a wrap structure.
So all these rates aren't fixed for the term?
They are fixed.
Yeah.
They are absolutely fixed.
Okay.
They're absolutely fixed.
And what's the capital coming from? Is it in U.S. capital or is it foreign capital? Or?
Well, in the case of a private placement, it's bank capital. Now, where do they get their capital? You know, if you go to Wells Fargo or Bank of America, I don't work for a commercial
bank. It's not a commercial bank, though.
So if it's a commercial bank, I can't tell you exactly where they get their capital. If it's a public offering like your 2012 offering was, you're talking primarily about institutional investors, domestic insurance companies primarily, and domestic institutional investors like Vanguard and Fidelity. You need to remember that these are tax-exempt obligations. And so a foreign entity is not likely going to be interested in the lower rates associated with a tax-exempt
obligation. Right? So primarily domestic capital.
One of the concerns I have about amortizing this over long term, we just had a huge outgo in our first bond sale. We're looking at $8 million now. 4, 5, 6 years down the road, if the water board calls for something new, it's millions of dollars, and we have an infrastructure failure again, we have two long term debts, we'll be taking on a third one. And I guess wondering, I mean, how far do you want to stretch yourself out? We don't know what's coming in the future. We've been warned pretty much that there's plenty more to come. So you really think, keeping that in mind, that it's a good idea to have two long term debts like this, and we may have other outlays on top of it?
Greg's probably the best person to answer that question in terms of what's on the horizon with respect to future wastewater.
There's been sort of two options for discussion for financing projects. There's two projects. In our permit, it is the filtration project and some miscellaneous projects that kind of cling to it. And that in the CIP right now is floating right around $7 million. And that was planned to start, you know, essentially January-ish, you know, we need to be ready to get to the design's done, right? The design's done, you know, it's about financing the building now. The regional board has a second project, the nitrogen denitrification project that's on. Now, we just finished a master plan update. We looked at the impact of that nitrogen project. Now, it's technically scheduled for 5 years down the road. So it's like 4 years after the filter job that you have to build. In your permit that you have to do it by that date. That budget came in at $7 million. So it is what you're saying, like if you proceeded here at seven, then 3 or 4 years down the road, you gotta turn around and get it in at seven, okay? We did do some on-site piloting of an alternate technology that tested and passed testing, but a commitment has been made to it yet, whereby we use the filter project to denitrify. We have to add more stuff to it. We gotta make them deeper, we gotta redesign it, but we could do it. That decision has been made. Now the advantage of that decision is, from a capital perspective, it's maybe $1 to $2 million more added to our existing project, and you get both. Right? Now there's a hit on the O&M side, but on the capital side, it's less expensive, dramatically less expensive. We haven't committed to either yet, you know, so there is a scenario where we've talked to the regional board about, well, let us adjust some dates and let us build it together and do this kind of combined filter project that's together, in which case the total cost is floating around $8 to $9 million total, right? But that the board level decision hasn't made yet. You know, we have alternatives and advantages, disadvantages. We have to get people on board decision-wise, some things like that. We've also talked to the regional board about giving us some time to further evaluate that and make an informed decision before we just pull the trigger. So at the moment, there's two things can happen. You can issue seven, and 4 years later issue seven more. Or you might issue nine, eight to nine, or maybe eight, and then use some of your own funds, right, to pick up some of the money. So, and that might occur right away, or it might occur a year from now. You know, we're trying to figure that out. So, really, both scenarios can happen. Beyond that, you more have to look at, we have, you know, certain aging facilities and costs like that. But I don't foresee the regional board jumping on something yet again, since that's really, you know, you're at filters, denitrification. You know, you're pretty far down the road of what they can build at a treatment plant. I mean, there's more, but it is extremely uncommon and not very, the only thing is if they came back and said, well, what about phosphorus or something? No one's talking about it, but no one's talking about nitrogen a while back. I mean, ten years out, your permit covers 2 years. They wrote two things in for two permits, covers 10 years. 10 years from now, I don't know what the regional board will be wanting, but they usually do want something. It's true that, you know, they want to give you some better treatment or something or some new criteria and the delta's an issue. You know, that's what drives it. And this nitrogen was driven by the EPA. The EPA came out with new nitrogen guidelines that forced the regional board to act. And it isn't just here, by the way, it's all Central Valley and all the Bay Area. They're having to get
right. My concern is going out and look for 30 years for two loans, knowing that there's other things coming. And wondering how many loans we can service. And I think I just wonder if it's prudent to go out for 30 years on two loans.
Yeah, well, yeah, I agree. So the answer is, depending on what you finance, something else could be coming in as short as 4 years. And then, regardless of that, it is true that the regional board usually deems you on something coming down the line. But you also, just under capital replacement, capital structures, when you start talking 10 years down the road, 20 years down the road, remember, you built the plant in 2002, right? 2012 was 10 years old. 2022 is 20 years old. You know, at some point, you have to do capital just to come back and maintain the facilities. You know, they need maintenance to go. They'll go a long time, but they don't go forever without maintenance. You know, and that's usually some form of capital repairs, you know, concrete and some other things to spruce them up and stuff. And, you know, Treatment Plant 1 is older than all that. I mean, Treatment Plant 1 started in the 70s.
And we've talked about that. Yeah. It's come up. And I mean, that's probably what my question is. We know that we have in the next 10 years.
I think it's unlikely that you'll ever have to continue to get some financing out. I think there will be something that you'll have to finance out.
Can I ask a question? Paul, looking at the numbers that you show and the coverages, as you go in those out years, that last 2 or 3 years, we're well over 1.2%, if that's a 1.2 coverage. So if we had an additional need sometime out at 3 to 5 or 7 years, assuming these numbers trend that way, there's more than enough capacity for the town of Discovery Bay to issue more debt. Is that the correct statement?
At these 11% rate increases.
Yeah, annually. So the key is, assuming you keep up with 11% annually increasing your rates, yes, you get ahead of the game and you can issue more debt down.
You can't do it.
Whether it was 8 or 9 or whatever.
That is modeling that you will have to do. So let me give you my reaction on observations, and some of it is informed by the fact that I too serve as a director on a few boards, and I'm the finance chair of one of them, so it's not so hard for me to put myself in your positions. What you're talking about is strategic financial planning. So I can sit up here at the introduction as I introduce myself, I just talk about strategic financial advice, and I know that those words, they kind of, like, what does that mean? What they mean is what you're referring to, and that is a plan of attack to get the district's financial position and financial profile into a framework such that you take as much of the guesswork out of the future as you can. Obviously, you can't wring it all out. Obviously, you can't. But you can put it in place. Some strategic financial planning is going to help a lot. Now, let me, if I can just kind of go on for a moment. Are you the district engineer?
Yeah.
Yeah. And so, a lot of good things have been brought up here, and this is a workshop that we're supposed to have back and forth. So bear with me. One could argue that the most prudent thing to do for a district each and every year is to not just handle depreciation as an accounting treatment, but actually fund it for the reasons that the district engineer mentioned. Because it's one thing to handle depreciation as an accounting treatment, it's another thing to actually set aside renewal and replacement monies. And very few public and not-for-profit agencies do it for obvious reasons. The additional burden on the ratepayers that are associated with that. But that's not to say that as a strategic financial planning matter, that consideration of how to handle depreciation as a strategic matter shouldn't be given some serious consideration. I don't know the degree to which
this district has been funding depreciation and we know replacement. We know all replacement. And I'm not here to pass judgment either. I mean, I get the economic realities of serving constituents. I would also say, as a bit of a parallel comment, that when you are a purveyor of essential services, like I don't mean to preach, but when you're a purveyor of essential services and you're providing mission, when you're a purveyor of essential services and from time to time you have mission critical capital improvements that need to be funded, the question isn't if you're going to fund them. The question is when and how. And again, I don't mean to be pedantic, but that's either going to be out of existing reserves that you've set aside through renewal, replacement, and depreciation, or through accessing capital like we're talking about here, or some combination thereof. I believe as a municipal advisor, as a financial advisor, there's a certain amount of planning and a framework and modeling, to use your words, that can be put in place to facilitate that and to take some of the guesswork out, because I like to, when I'm in the position of a director in my own personal financial circumstances, I like to sleep at night. And I don't want to worry about whether or not I can afford the debt that might be associated with the improvements that I know about and the ones that I don't know about but that might happen. So I like to have kind of a rainy day policy. I said a lot there, but I don't know that I responded directly to your question. Your question was, and I also want to say that as a fiduciary, kind of, I'm not in a position to, at this point, to, and I'm not recommending 2-30-year loans. We're just talking, you know, we're just having a discussion. But the answer really is, does it make sense? I would say we don't have enough information right now to know whether that makes sense. There are scenarios that include how you handle depreciation, how you handle rate increases, and what happens with your expenses associated with your private operator and whatnot, that might suggest that it makes a lot of sense. And conversely, it might suggest that it makes absolutely no sense.
It also depends on the residential real estate market, if Pantages and Newport Point come on, and if we structured the current set, and you may recall, specifically at your request, so that 10 years out, we could pay them down earlier if we wanted to. And we could do the same thing in this case as well. So that's always an option that we rolled into the last ones. If we're gonna do something like that similar this time, I'm always looking strategically where the money's coming from, and I know we've got some money in the bank, and once Pantages and Newport Point hit, assuming they do, those two projects alone would pay for the project. It would pay for almost entirely the project. So.
Well, to Director Lee's point, I like the notion of having a financial model, a long-term financial model, and stress testing it. Because growth may occur at the rate that you think, and it may not.
Right.
But it's good to know that if in a worst case scenario, you can still afford what you've obligated yourself to. And I think it, financial modeling, the stress testing, the strategic financial planning, it sounds more complicated than it really is, I would submit.
I just kind of hate to count on Pantages and Newport Point because there's been no movement there of any kind. You just don't know. They may build, they may not. I mean, to the Solony have come and been building with the kind of.
They're on the hook for $5.4 million.
If they build it.
If all units get built that, yeah.
They're making no movement toward building it. And they probably will. I mean, I'm assuming eventually they're going to have to move, but who knows? Whether it'll be 10 years or 5 years or so, they may sell it off. I mean, you just don't know.
Yeah.
Ready?
So really, we've covered the things that we set out to talk about, which was, you know, have a discussion that's food for thought, frame up the discussion, frame it in terms of future debt capacity and affordability in terms of your existing debt, and your current financial profile, and talk about options for accessing capital. We put that on the table, and now I'm happy to answer any and all questions that you might have. But
what's the current interest on our current debt?
4.07.
4.07. And today's rate could be 3.71.
Correct. Could be lower, yes.
So on volume, if we were to refinance that and roll it into a package all in one, is there significant cost savings?
So here's the
issue. District to that?
That's a good question. And here's the issue with that. Your existing debt cannot be called away from the current holders of that debt. Before
you can't repay it.
Yeah. Actually,
you can advance refund it. You can advance refund it, as you know. Okay. Here's the thing. The bonds, while you can take the proceeds of a new loan and place them in an escrow that will pay the principal and interest on the 2012 bonds until their call date in 2022, you can do that. The new loan rate is going to be 3.71, let's call it. And you're going to place it in an escrow that has a final maturity of 2022. So what is that? 7 years, right? So the average life of that is going to be, let's call it 3.5 years. You're going to be taking money that you borrowed at 3.71, and you're going to be investing it at, let's call it 1%. It's not going to make sense. That's the problem. Now, conversely, if interest rates had gone up significantly since 2012, the problem would be, well, there's really not a refinancing opportunity because interest rates are higher than they were, but you'd be able to invest the loan proceeds in the escrow at a higher rate.
Arbitrage is your problem.
Correct. Negative arbitrage.
Negative.
It's called negative arbitrage in particular. But it's a good question to ask about, is there a refinancing opportunity with respect to the existing debt?
That ain't worked with those things.
Correct.
But the wraparound works, you know, sort of the same.
Yeah, I mean, you know, there's a, you know, what I kind of, the way I think about it is, you know, this is a normal, if this is time down here, this is time, and this is rate. A normal yield curve goes up such that as an investor, you're being compensated the longer you're willing to take the risk that a district is going to be able to continue making its payments. You're getting a higher reward in terms of a rate. And that's kind of a normal yield curve. We kind of got this funky yield curve that's very, very low right now.
It's not steep at all.
But the good news is that you can borrow at historically low rates. It kind of blows your mind to hear it, but over the last 30 years, you've been able to borrow at rates this low less than 5% of the time over the last 30 years.
Consolidating projects into one, or being able to split into two. What's the time horizon where this board would have to start making some decisions if we're going to need $8 million in that? How many years, Greg?
Well,
assuming they accept us.
Assuming they accept it, we ask for 2 more years. So 2 years from now.
Or sooner, if we want to move it, if we want to do it sooner.
What's that?
Or sooner, if we choose to move it.
Sooner if we choose to do it sooner.
Well, I guess the question is, how long does it take, once we make a decision to move forward, for that funding to take place?
To come together?
Like, how do you put your team together?
I think a reasonable pace would be,
That's what it took last time, right?
About 4 months.
4 months. Yeah.
From the time we actually hit pavement, about 4 months.
Once the board voted to go move forward with it, plan, whatever
that is. Once they voted to move forward, it took a while for the team to get pulled together. But once the team got put together and everybody was on board, which took probably a month, if I recollect somebody, that probably 4 months after that. So yeah, by the time you get the go ahead, probably 5 months.
So if we plan, if the board today thinks that we need to be 6 months out, we've got to make a decision 6 months out prior to getting that funding, and that's when we need to get something going to be able to.
Because a contract couldn't be written until that funding was in place.
As a public agency, you can't go out to bid.
Right.
So knowing that once we know our date, that we've got to be.
What you're asking is how far can we push this without making a decision?
I don't want to push it to that limit.
No, I agree. No, that's a good number to know.
The difficult part about this is your permit right now says you have to be done by 2017 with the filter project. That's not changed yet. We called the regional board up, we wrote up a letter, we sent a bunch of stuff. They've never answered. So right now, your permit, and I'm to advise you that based upon your current permit limits, if the regional board doesn't come back and give you relief, you pretty much need to be ready to go out to bid in January. Now, the bid period is a couple months or whatever, so we only got a couple more months of trying to get action or reaction out of the regional board before you're starting to run out of time to do what's in your permit right now.
To get the funding in place.
So we're at that point right now. Yeah. We're there.
You had a conversation offline with Jim Marshall.
Yes.
And Jim's initial thought was acceptance.
Jim's idea said he thought it sounded like a good idea.
But we have to go through the process instead of paperwork.
He had to take it up to people above him.
Right.
And remember, we've been calling the regional board since March. So it wasn't like we just wrote a letter. I mean, we sent them emails in March, we sent them a draft plan in April. We started alerting them that, hey, we want to modify what's in our permit right now. And recognize to modify the permit, we have to go to a public hearing at the regional board level. They have to open our permit, have a public hearing, change the dates in the permit, and give it new dates, they close it. Okay? We are subject to challenge at that point, things. But I think if staff was strong behind it, it would go through, kind of thing. We just haven't gotten a reaction. We've gotten a verbal reaction, but we haven't gotten any more.
So, Greg, what you're saying is there's sort of two options after, two alternatives that are likely on the
product.
One, we're going to have to do it by 2017, and we'll worry about what happens later.
Right.
Or they're going to combine them and give us another date. But that gets back to my point on preparing a model.
Yeah.
And the model could be model A and model B. Show that to our budgetary people, we can show it to the investment community and figure out.
So the reason we started the race study,
back into our numbers.
Right, but the reason we started the race study right away, which you already authorized, is because we don't know exactly. Let's put this way, on paper, you got 6 months, okay? But that's what it says right now that you have to do. And we have this other option, and we're not clear, but exactly what you're saying. It's one thing to say, let's go get financing. This other thing is, let's start planning now, and you really need to start planning now. That's the key. You have to start planning now. We're running out of time.
Okay. So, to that point, as you having, let's say you're the investment banker on this deal, and we have two options like that, we really don't know what answers. As you would present this to the investment community, would they understand a deal like that is that it's going to be either, you know, $8 million now and $4 million later, or it's going to be 8 or 9 now and not anything later? Is there a way you can set up, you know, you could sell this thing in tranches or whatever?
Sure.
I'm not sure what the terminology is, but just sell it out, and maybe you don't go to that last tranche, you don't sell it.
So to that I would say,
or is this overcomplexed?
No, no. I'd say was, I'd say that to the extent that you have a plan of finance, because that's what we're talking about, plan of funding or plan of finance, that is coherent and articulate and concise, you can sell it.
So we can deal with those variables.
You can deal
with something that's going to happen 2 years down the road, but the investment community say we understand that and we're willing to buy it.
If the plan of finance is coherent, getting including the variables, coherent, articulate, and most importantly, not if I can articulate this, but if the district can articulate that this is our plan and these are our contingency plans. Because oftentimes what I'm faced with is, will the market accept it? The question, will the market accept it? And my advice is, first and foremost, can you live with it? Have you evaluated it and analyzed it in the plainest terms, the plainest plain English terms that you can understand so that you are comfortable that given reasonable, you know, unintended consequences, you are able to sleep at night? Once the district embraces it and understands it, it's a much simpler matter to convince the external community, the rating agencies, and the investors that the plan makes sense.
And as we do that, do you have a sense as to how that community, the investment community, how they might view the town of Wisconsin Bay Community Services District? So, you know, at East Bay, but they kind of know how to make some of the deals pretty straightforward. You know, we've got one issue out there. Are we well enough to know that at this point that we're strong enough?
Yeah, and again, but really, the devil's in the details of your plan of finance and your financial model. The devil in the details is, as an investor, I'm going to want to see this in a form that I think is credible. I think it's credible. You've put in place the rate increases that are necessary to fund the mission-critical capital projects that you can expect, and that those rate increases are, that they're in place, that you're handling and funding depreciation, and basically that you're managing, that I have faith that the district's governance and management is solid. Now I can tell you, so you might ask, well, I'm sorry, I know you have a question. You might ask, well, first of all, strength of management, for those of you that have done bond issues in the past, if there's four or five key criteria that go into a rating assessment, strength of management is one of them. And it's one of the hardest things to measure. What's evidence of strength of management? Policies. You know, for example, reserve policies. What sort of financial planning, what sort of financial modeling and key performance indicators do you look at on a periodic basis, twice a year, such that you, if somebody asks you, how do you measure financial success? Because investors are much more discriminating than they used to be. So they're going to wonder, you might come up and ask, how do you measure financial success? Years ago, you never would have gotten that. Unfortunately, a lot of potential borrowers would just kind of sit there and go, but if you say, well, our management, twice a year, they present us with these key financial indicators that show these key ratios on how we're performing based on key metrics. That's pretty compelling for an investor.
So it's our duty then to get to Moody's and Standard & Poor's or whatever else and say, and present that case.
Absolutely. 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 Saul. Question. You know, we're talking about timing.
I'm just a board member. Go ahead, Greg. I'm just kidding.
The timing on the bonds, no matter what, within 2 years, guys, you're no matter what, even the regional board said yes, within 2 years, you're issuing bonds. Mm-hmm. You're doing something.
Something.
The real question is, do we have to do something in the next 6 months? And that's where we don't know yet.
And that was yes,
if you know for a fact you will have to issue bonds within 2 years, you know, the Fed's been talking about raising interest rates, and this thing's coming out at the end of this year, and other things. You know, is there a risk profile where, you know what, 18 months to, or 6 months or 18 months after that, you know, in 6 months to 2 years, no matter what, we have to borrow this amount of money just to get in the game. Is there a reason that you would say, you know what, you know, use district funds first, plan on your bonds 12 months, use district funds to cover the beginning of it, and you would just say, you know what, start targeting the money 12 months from now, the interest rate will be lower now than it will 2 years from now.
Okay, so let me respond to that. I'm not being cute or smart ass. Timing the market and trying to crystal ball the market is just not a wise thing to try to do in my experience. Inevitably, you're gonna be wrong. I believe that the best advice is. You know what the market is today and make decisions based on what you know. Trying to predict what the market is going to be in the future, I think, is just, I frankly don't think that municipal entities have the resources, in-house resources, to do that sort of speculative, let's call it. There was something else I was going to say. Oh, you have. Go ahead, please.
So to get back to this sense of urgency that Director Peace was talking, kind of think it's starting to ask questions about, or this perceived sense of urgency of when we need to make a decision on this in order to be able to fund what we need to have funded at a particular time, and to bring in exactly what Greg was talking about, and that is, what's the advantage of doing it in January, doing it 18 months after January, because it has to be done. We don't know which way that the board is, that Sacramento is going to go on this thing. I mean, I don't see a real advantage in waiting a long time to make this decision. I think that we need the funding. If we do it sooner, it's probably going to cost us less. That's kind of the tradition in construction. If prices go up, as things go on, and right now the housing industry is going nuts, and construction prices are going up on everything. It's costing $50 a square foot more to build a house now than it did 3 months ago. And I know that's a different market, but a lot of the trades cross over with regards to concrete and other things. I just think that we really do have kind of a sense of urgency to make a decision on this and go ahead and go after the funding and not think about what Sacramento may allow us to do 2 years from now.
I agree with you, Kevin, and I think that if we can begin the establishment of that model that can be adjusted over the next couple of months, that takes into consideration the variables, which ways, you know, the winds are going to blow in Sacramento, we'll be able to, you know, number one, if we don't do anything now, we'll never get there. So why not start now? Start the model, and as Greg knows more from the regional board, we'll be able to fine-tune the model. Construction costs a little tighter. We'll know which way this is going to go in terms of one project or two projects. But I think that the initial thing that we should do here real quickly is establish that model. I suggest we have a finance committee or something to just, you know, begin the development of it, and then we can bring it back to the full board for some analysis, discussion, work with Saul and his group, or whatever we're going to do to make sure that model is viable, so that when we do have to present a moving standard investors and put it into an official statement. And all the things that we need to do is, we're ahead of the game. We're not scrambling during that 120 days. When 120 days starts, we've got our financial model, we have our story together, and then it's turned over to an outfit like yours the revenue package, and that's it.
And I think that, I mean, I'm, this is stating obvious, but we need to start with plan A. And plan A is that in 2 years, by 2017, we have to have the filter project completed. Exactly. That would be the model we start with, and then we add the variables to that, correct?
That would be model A. That's a guarantee for sure. Model B would be, well, if they decided...
Whatever they are.
Model C is, you know, when we deal with something else, since we can think about it. But we have that.
Can it be constructed that way?
Numbers and dates. Sure. It's not that hard.
So what would the team consist of besides your role in FAA?
So we would serve as your financial advisor.
Okay.
Okay. You need a lender, obviously. Right. That's either going to be a bank or an underwriter. And you need bond counsel, because bond counsel's primary role is to opine that the interest on the debt is exempt from state and federal taxes. So that's the bond work and the tax work. Tax-exempt securities laws, pretty arcane, specialized work. Those are the three main parties. Bond counsel, a lender, financial advisor.
So the FAA, in your role, you would be the one that would assist us walking us through what we're talking about here relative to getting back to S&P and doing a revised statement there. Revised rating, right. You would be that person, or that your team would assist in that process, correct?
Correct.
Okay. So that's something that you're helping us do.
Correct.
Okay.
And so in terms of, you know, once we get to the point of pulling the trigger on a bond, so negotiated versus what's the market like? Which way do you kind of, you know the town of Discovery Bay, what's going on in the market? Which way are you going?
That's a good question.
East of Newtown.
You know, there's pros and cons, and I have prepared slides on for that very question. I bring them with me, but in an effort to answer those, and I'd be happy to share them with you. There's pros and cons to both. One of the pros is if you engage an underwriter, they have that 6 month period of time to really get to know the texture of the district. And so that when they're going out to sell the bonds, your job is to sell the bonds at the highest prices possible, right? And so that can facilitate that. In a competitive offering, you don't have that, you don't build that relationship with an underwriter. I think that an argument could be made that a water revenue bond or wastewater revenue bonds are sufficiently commodity-like that a competitive placement would be just fine. So I think it'd be premature to say one way or another, but I would be open to both.
And how about, you know, a water or sewer revenue bond versus a certificate of participation?
So it's, first of all, it wouldn't be a water or sewer bond versus a certificate of participation. It would be a water or sewer bond versus a water or sewer certificate of participation. And the inefficiencies that existed in that comparison of bonds versus certificates years ago is largely been wrung out of the market. And any investor who is really worth their salt is going to realize that as long as they have an obligation, the evidence is a hell or high water obligation to raise rates or whatever sufficient to cover the debt service, they have ample security. The security features between a water revenue and a bond and a certificate, are going to be virtually identical.
Yeah. I too agree. I think we need to move now. Regardless of what Sacramento does, I hope that we can combine the two projects into one. And also, knowing what the interest rates are today, we don't know 6 months from now what might happen, 8 months from now. I don't see it going any lower. So I think it's to our advantage to go out and get the funding in place, get it now, and get do the analysis both ways. If we need more monies or do it, we need two shots on it, whatever it is. So I'd say let's put the finance committee to work and get it back to the board.
I would say at the same time, we're going to start looking at the 11% revenue increase that we're going to need and where that's coming from, because basically, we have less water consumption right now, which means we're going to need a rate increase just to get back to zero, plus 11%.
Wastewater, not water.
Oh, it's wastewater.
All wastewater. Yeah, it's all wastewater, there's no water.
Okay.
So it's not the water size.
So it's being hit from both sides, yeah. But not compounding on one side.
Right.
So directors, I just want to emphasize that I know it's human nature to hang your hat on things that we present here. You have engaged, I understand, a formal rate study. So this is just for illustrative purposes. It might, 11% is just our best estimate for purposes of this illustration. But we need to wait to get the benefit of that investment.
Well, once we have the financial model and we have the rate study, we can kind of work together and see where each of them hold the money.
Oh, without a doubt.
That's right.
The board does have some options. It's a workshop. You can take an action, but you can certainly give direction. Saul is certainly well qualified to move this forward. There are other options out there, there's other organizations, businesses such as his. So if you want to look and do that as well, we can certainly do that. But I would recommend that Saul's work with CSDs and his relationship with CSDA and the different entities that are out there that have done the work and has been through the trenches with them. And I got to know Saul pretty well over the last couple of years, and I've gotten to him for advice and guidance in certain areas not related to this type of thing, but in other areas. And I would recommend the board that we eventually move forward if you want to do so with Saul's firm. Also, there are two committees that are involved in this. It would be both the wastewater and the finance committee. They kind of come at it from different angles. And so since that represents four of you, maybe we do another, we'll bring it back to the committee as an individual and then come back again as another workshop to the board. Since it does involve four of you, and there's five of you, so it really doesn't make sense not to be involved in the whole process. But it does involve both committees.
So you want to do that in the next 30 days?
Well, yeah, we have a water wastewater committee scheduled next Wednesday or Thursday, next Wednesday, and we can schedule a finance committee meeting at, you know, any time.
Why don't we do this? So I'll give you give us a proposal, you know, for your services, and we can at least switch it now.
Sure.
And then we can call either a finance committee or a wastewater committee or a combined committee of the whole at a date.
As a special meeting.
In the next week or two. So let's begin the process of looking at the model, looking at how we want to proceed, and move on from there.
I would. We do have a meeting coming up, wastewater. Maybe you guys, maybe the finance committee should just meet real briefly and bring a recommendation into a special meeting where we can finalize decisions. We'll all have input, but you guys can raise whatever questions you have individually, and they're probably the same questions we have. And make a recommendation back to us at a special meeting?
That's fine.
Soon.
Soon.
That makes sense, Mr. President?
Yeah, I was shooting for
it. I have a question on services like yours, like having to do a bond issue.
Sure.
What's kind of typical as far as the fees a firm like yours? You know, you're in to make money, naturally you have to. Profit's good word, I don't have a problem with it.
Sure.
What's typical service charge for assisting a district like this?
For financial advisory services?
And taking it through and bond underwriting and all that kind of stuff.
It's probably going to be similar to what a bond counsel is going to charge. You know, one of it is handling legal aspects, another is handling the financial and the business aspects. But I think in both those cases, I don't know what you pay for your bond counsel. And
it was statutory. Isn't it statutorily? No. Oh, not for bond counsel, but for the underwriter side.
No, but I would say that just in dollar terms, you're looking at $75,000 for, you're talking about a good 6 months of financial advisory work.
Right, so it's approximately 75 for a firm like yours.
Yeah.
And what about the bond counsel?
Bond counsel is going to be roughly equivalent.
$75,000.
Yeah, and then you're going to have the lender is going to have some sort of origination fee. They're either going to call it an underwriter discount if it's a public offering, and that could be another $50,000 on an $8 million.
But the trustees on the other side.
Trustee is going to be about $3,500. I can put together a whole.
Yeah, listen.
We need that proposal.
Approximately $200,000.
Yeah.
And services to be able to go out.
Access account.
Total cost efficiency.
Yep.
All right. Prefer to go up to the front. We're getting a warm investment.
It's 14 pounds.
We'll have the party.
Oh, you're not too far.
Any other discussion on this?
Are you available next Wednesday afternoon?
Yes, I think I fly back. I'm in Tennessee, and I fly back on Tuesday, and so I think I'm there on Wednesday.
So, Rick, you know what we need to do?
Coordinate.
Okay. All right. Well, thank you very much for coming out tonight.
I appreciate it.
Thanks, Paul.
Information. My pleasure. All right. At this time, we are going to adjourn the workshop.
Good evening and welcome to the regular meeting of the Board of Directors of the Town of Discovery Bay. At this time, I'd like to call our meeting to order. We've already had the Pledge of Allegiance, so we'll move on to the next item. Roll call, please.
President Steele?
Here.
Vice President Pease?
Here.
Director Graves?
Still here.
Director Lee?
Here.
Director Simon?
Still here.
Great. Public comments. Public comments will be limited to a 3-minute time limit. Public may address the board on any issue within the jurisdiction, the district's jurisdiction, which is not on the agenda. The public may comment on any item on the agenda at the time that the item is before the board for consideration. Any person wishing to speak must come up and speak from the podium at the front of the room. There'll be no dialogue between the board and the commenter. Any clarifying questions from the board must go through the chair. Any public comment? All right, no public comment tonight. We'll move on to item C1, capital improvements program update.
That's going to have to hold over to the next meeting. Greg's been slammed working on getting the projects completed at the plant, the big basin, the big dig, if you will. So he's going to be back at the first meeting in August with that.
All right, let's move on to President's report and director's comments. Anything?
No, I'm gonna report my report as an ECF PDA. It's on the agenda.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. All right, I don't have anything to get it right now. So we'll move on to consent calendar.
I make a motion.
Second. All those in favor?
Aye.
Unanimous. All right, opening up to our public hearing. Turn it over to staff.
Thank you, Mr. President, members of the board. This item is an annual item that comes before you. It is a public hearing to consider the Town of Discovery Bay's Ravenswood Landscape Zone Number 9 Park Lighting and Open Space Improvement District for the fiscal year 2015-2016, the continuation of assessments on the county tax roll in the amount of $606.94. Which is about $7, about $6, actually it's $4 more this year than it was the last fiscal year. And there's an attachment to this report that explains the methodology that goes into it. And Herwood Engineering did the report. They presented to you at the last meeting as well. not a lot to say on this item. It's an annual item that comes before the board. It's basically to assess the L&L Zone 9 annual assessment and the ability for the town to continue to collect those revenues on the property tax roll.
This is the same information we saw at the last meeting.
You saw the information in a different format, but yes.
Right.
You saw the engineer's report that this information derived from.
Any public comment?
Mr. President, if you could, can you officially open the public hearing, take public comment, then close the public hearing, and then take action? Because this is a public hearing item.
Okay, we're opening our public hearing. Any public comment? Okay. I'll close public comment now, and any motions, discussion?
Move staff recommendation.
Second.
All those in favor?
Aye.
Aye.
Thank you. Close public hearing.
All good.
All right, we've got item G, East Contra Costa County Fire Protection District update.
Thank you, Mr. President, members of the board. Board gave direction about 6 weeks or so ago to have this item come back before the board for legal counsel consideration to address the ECCFPD Board of Directors in the district. And so I added that to the agenda this evening. There's no written report since you've already heard some of the items on it. I know that Director Graves is very familiar with this, and I know that he is interested to enlighten the board on what's going on in the district.
Thank you, staff. At this point, I would ask that we open up to public comment. We have another gentleman in the audience has been working directly with the ECCFPD and is extremely knowledgeable about what's going on with regards to the situation, and I would invite us to open up to public comment at this point.
All right, let's do it. Public comment. Hey.
Thank you, Mr. President, members of the board. Been a while since we've got some nice big digs, I see. So, first of all, I just want to say I've been following the fire district pretty actively since they were set. 2009, 2010, whatever it was, 5 years. Disappointed in the actions they've taken over there, which are next to nothing. My sort of desperately say for them, and they just spent 5 years rearranging the deck chairs over there, really haven't taken the action on the thing they were most tasked with, which is finding a revenue stream to support operations and give us a reasonable fire department, for God's sake. That's all we're really looking for. We're not looking for a big deal. To the point, the more current issue, more pressing issue, and obviously I saw most of you folks over at the meeting there in May, and I want to publicly thank Director Graves because I reached out to him on Friday before that meeting, and he got active and he mobilized you folks and many of the members of the committee that you saw there, and I can tell you with a high degree of likelihood that if you had not gotten in there and got engaged that night, that was going to go a different direction. We'd be sitting here right now without a fire station at all in Discovery Bay. I'm highly confident that was where that was going. The problem is not obvious to the public at large, but the fact of the matter is the union doesn't support this fire station being out here. Neither do select members of the board. So they want to place fire stations relative to call volume, which is a flawed metric in my opinion. I've argued that for 5 years in front of that body, but they can't seem to get off of that. So that's their whole basis for establishing placement of fire stations. Chief Henderson stood up and had a station placement recommendation that protected this community, and he was our biggest firewall, if you will, in that going the wrong way. So again, I thank you for your efforts in that because it did make a difference. Unfortunately, the thought process or the desires of certain board members didn't dive with that vote. If you listen to dialogue carefully, some of them made sense to you. But because I've engaged with it, it made sense to me what they were trying to do. even before they took the vote that night, they were already sort of lining up to get a new data set to support a second vote, which is still potentially coming, which will take out station 59. You'll end up with two stations in Brentwood, one of them. Your response times will get silly with some pretty undesirable outcomes. So that's the problem. There's a public records request, which I issued about 6 weeks ago, for emails of the director, so I kind of see what their thought process was. I don't think they're really familiar with public records requests over there, so I kind of caught some of them out. And it's clear that there was some collusion between certain board members and the union for that station placement. So it's not a drill, it's not a head fake, it's like that's where they want to go with it. I see the vote of no confidence on the chief as a two-step process. He was the firewall, so if you need captain now, then come with your vote next month or the month after, you could potentially get your station big. So that's the risk. Like I said, it doesn't bode well for the community of Discovery Bay. And doing that is going to be extremely difficult if it does take place. If you're going to have to get legal on it, you can make a case, I think. I'm happy to share with you the public records that I did retrieve in that effort. I think if you read those, you're going to see the dialogue and you're going to understand where they're going. But you've got assets out here in community and constituents you got to protect. It's actually a legal issue, I think it's easier to get involved before rather than after that vote potentially takes place. So I know the protocol is not to have a dialogue here, but I'm happy to answer your questions that you might have. But if anything you can do to kind of, you know, preempt that, or at least make the full board aware that you're paying attention to that, and you're willing to engage if it goes badly, it'll probably be in our best interest.
I have a couple questions for you.
Yes,
approximately how many emails did you receive from your request?
It was 150 pages worth. To be honest with you, 90% of it was probably just junk.
But there's not after your analysis of how many board members were speaking about this issue.
Well, it's not just emails. You have to be at all the meetings to see the dialogue that takes place, and also go to the subcommittee meetings, which includes finance and outreach.
So I understand that, but
there are three firefighters on the board, so that should be.
I understand that too, but you mentioned that you have emails showing that board members were conversing with each other. So my specific question is, how many board members did you read that talking about this subject?
I would say there's two or three emails that make it clear that a particular board member is kind of fronting the effort, although again, the dialogue extends beyond just those emails. And clearly he was working with and conversing with the union, pushing hard to bring forward the study that everybody was. Most of you all were meeting the ICU. You saw that study before. They were trying to not make a big deal out of that. The union and a few board members really want to make a big deal out of it, because that's going to be the pivot point to opposing Station 59 to go away.
I understand it too. Thank you.
No comment?
I just want to thank Bob Mankin for coming forward and presenting that information, and also for doing some of that research and making me aware of it. Thanks, Bob. I appreciate your input on that. If I may, Mr. President,
sure.
I would ask that Mr. Mankin make those emails available to our attorney, so that he can look at it, analyze, and see if there is some more thing. I don't know that there's a. I'm not sitting here to accuse anybody of breaking the law at this point, but I do think that it's important that our board take a vote here tonight to direct our attorney to write a letter to the ECCFPD stating exactly that there are assets out here that we're responsible for as a board to protect, and that if they take away Station 59, it will hamper our responsibility to our constituents, and not hamper, it'll obliterate our responsibility to our constituents to protect their assets, as well as our own personal, the own personal assets of the constituents that we represent. And so the action that I'm looking for here tonight is a vote from the board to direct council to put together a letter to the ECCFPD that states that legally we don't believe that we should be abandoned out here. And I would leave that up to our attorney to put into words that would be appropriate, but that's the gist of what I'm trying to get across.
I would agree with that. I also would like to ask a question of council. Is that a nine-member board, I recall?
Yeah, it is. Yes.
So if three of them are talking, then that's not a Brown Act violation, correct?
That's correct.
Yes, you have to have five.
You need majority.
Yeah. But be that as it may, if board members are interfacing with the union, doesn't that cross the line a little bit?
It does not. And they can have dialogue just like you could from any of your constituency, any of your vendors out here. They could direct comments to you. It's a matter of looking at the emails and seeing whether there was a serial set of communications that allowed them to get on the same page before or outside of the context of a meeting. However, you know, I'll just caution you that the violation's a Brown Act violation. There are remedies for it, but I can tell you the remedy is largely a slap on the back of the wrist. And it doesn't necessarily invalidate any action that they otherwise take. But I think, you know, what I think Director Graves is pointing out that's important to note is that we're paying attention. It's not going unnoticed, and, they need to be careful. Some of these smaller districts just aren't as familiar with, as you heard the speaker talk about, Public Records Act requests, Brown Act. They're just not familiar enough with them. They don't have legal counsel. They don't have training on a regular basis that they follow through with. So I'm putting something like that. I think the more important issue, though, is what you're really driving at, which is the abandonment of Discovery Bay. And if they lose that particular station, your assets are put in jeopardy as a result of it, and that won't fall on deaf ears, I don't believe. I can't imagine they want to lose a station. That's loss of jobs. The union can't want it. That's loss of jobs. There's other revenue issues that are facing all of these fire districts, and I can tell you this district's not unique.
Thank you. The other question I'd like to make sure that you probably would address that is response times. Plus community safety, and then also the insurance costs for the community. Community assets to me aren't necessarily the building, the fire station, but every single residential home out here, plus all the commercial buildings that we have, that I would see would be community assets.
Yeah, I've represented a couple of fire districts on kind of unique issues, nothing directly associated with this kind of issue in terms of response time, how it affects your insurance rates, what legal obligations they have to provide response times. We do have, and you guys know him, Dan Schroeder. Dan Schroeder represents several fire districts, and he may be aware of that as well. But we can do that research, figure out whether there's a legal basis to claim that they can't abandon an area out here. You know, I'm going to have to do some research and figure out what are the areas around, what are the response times. I mean, I've seen them through the reports, but I haven't really thought about them in terms of this legal context as to whether they have a legal obligation to maintain that district.
Thank you.
Do you have something, Bob?
Yeah, I think Kevin, you bring up a very good point. I'm wondering if, sort of procedurally, it might be best a letter from our board president to their board president advising them that we're very concerned with any discussions that they have with regard to Station 59. Any action they might contemplate, it would be to their best interest to bring the town of Discovery Bay into that discussion to help represent the constituency out here. Because if they close 59, it's not a loss of job. They're just moving their firefighters to Brentwood and Oakley. So the firefighters are really happy with that. That drives them far so often. But there's other remedies out there that might be that they're certainly not exploring because of sort of the political issues of 1230 and such. So anyway, my suggestion is sort of board president, just sort of to keep us informed rather than the shot across the bow that we're concerned
sure
they're doing something. Let's let them come to us before we make that shot across the bow.
Yeah, I mean, my recommendation would be, I mean, I think you can get best of both worlds out of it. You know, I mean, I would draft the letter for the board president's signature, and I would indicate that the board has reached out to legal counsel, the legal counsel has reviewed it, and here's his analysis. And so okay. I put that in the context of the letter, and then it would come from the board president that you've actually spoken to our legal counsel, and the legal counsel has this analysis associated with it, provided this information I'm sending you the letter based on that analysis.
I would also like to see that letter sent to Supervisor Peoples' office, and also the president of the local firefighters union, so that the union's on board also, or at least notified where we're at.
And then one other point I'd like to bring up for legal counsel's awareness is that the county pays for the housing of the QRV in Station 59 because of the fact that we have all this infrastructure out here that supports so much traffic that's passing through to Brentwood, a lot of it. We have a QRV that the county finances out here. That would also go away. We'd lose the quick response vehicle out of Station 59 if they closed it down, because they would not continue to have that station open and maintained, which is another factor that would be to detriment to the entire district. And then the obvious, and what we're talking about here, we're really the only physical government entity in East Contra, this far in far East Contra Costa County, and that's why I think it's imperative that as a board we take a stand, not only to represent ourselves but represent those around us.
And just for transparency and for the record, I think that, you know, the best way to do that, since President Steele would be signing it and you seem to have the most knowledge about it, is that I would work with the two of you to get a letter out. You know, once I've had some time to do some research on it, that I would pass a letter between the two of you, and you two could help me draft it if there's issues that I'm missing. I would have never caught the QRV issue, so good to point that out. What's the timing in terms of when a second vote may occur?
We don't think it's going to happen in August, but is it moving that direction now?
They were shooting for July referendum, so they're already
so shooting for what?
That would be the first Monday in August. We'd like to have it done by, if that's at all feasible.
Okay.
You might also want to cover, you know, that as a first responder out on the Vasco Road in that area, the residents that we're serving, a lot of them are Brentwood and Oakley residents. Not that we're just, it's not just every business.
That passes the traffic, yeah.
These are people coming in that use that road to get to Brentwood and Oakley, and when there's a head on wreck on Vasco Road, and we're the first responder, there's a chance that's a Brentwood resident. It's a car. We don't seem to mind us helping them.
Just the point, Bob, is there anything that glaringly that we're leaving out of this?
You guys mostly touched on it. I will point out that there was a statement made by the one direct problematic director in particular who said doesn't care about the property values of Discover Bay. That's not his concern. I think in the staff report of a reasonable size agency, you generally see a fiscal impact statement or study in a staff report. It's non-existent over there. So your $250 million worth of assets sitting out there is not his concern, but worse, and this is probably the biggest issue, move the fire station to Brentwood, the road travel is over 5 miles for almost the entirety of Discovery Bay. You are in a no insurance zone in Orange Island.
Thank you. So I would move that we direct counsel to draft a letter and bring it back to the president for signature, and that we move forward with presenting it to ECC, FPD, and those that we requested CC as soon as possible.
Second.
All those in favor?
Aye. Aye. Aye.
All right. Moving on to item H, update on the water conservation measures.
Thank you. Real briefly, you know, we had 46% in May, we had 40% in June, and we're tracking about 40% for July right now. We are sending out our first set of letters to those folks that are not complying, the repeat offenders that have received more than two notices, and in some cases three. We have the ordinance that goes into effect, I believe, on August the 1st, which refines and clears up a little bit our ability to fine people. for violating notice, they receive a notice of violation. So we haven't done any fine letters up to this point. I really don't want to do any fines. I would hope we don't have to do that. But there's probably a few people who will be getting some fines here in the near future. And as soon as we do start doing that, I will let you know that at least it's hitting in case you get people calling you. And there is an appeal process. That appeal process, I don't actually recall everything that's in it right now. But there is an appeal process that residents can follow. You can see it for yourself, compliance is probably 80% plus. It's unfortunate it's the case that it is, but it is. It's good it's compliance, but it's unfortunate we're in this situation. Yesterday I was in at the CSDA meeting and I met with their legislative staff and had the discussion with him relative to the governor's emergency declaration. And I'm very strongly of the opinion, someone who's been involved with FEMA and emergency operations in the past, that this is no different than a flood in my mind. If we had flooding that tore out large portions of our landscaping and our infrastructure, and if it was significant enough, the governor would call the president, ask for a federal state of emergency, or federal emergency providing FEMA assistance. And so I've asked them to look into that, and he actually said to me, you know, that's a really good idea. He had to consider that. So hopefully we might get something out of that. I don't know. It's probably shot in the dark, but at least it's, they can go to the governor and represent the special districts that are out there. So I sent you all last week. I'm not sure if you had a chance to see it yet, but the latest NOAA updates looking promising. But if you read their caveats, an El Nino is no guarantee of precipitation. So we'll see what happens there. And that's really about the update that I have at this point, unless you have any questions.
Yeah, question on, you said there's some, are they residents in violation that staff is finding, or are these commercial operations or HOAs?
Yes. It's both, but it's primarily residential.
So that's coming from water?
It's
water conservation officer.
Water prop. Yeah, it's our we've just been on the beat there for the better part of 6-8 months since this went into effect last year, and he pretty much knows
same ones over and over.
There's a handful.
They don't respond.
They just don't respond.
Okay.
Which is unfortunate. But you know, I mean, the conservation numbers are good and solid. So we're in fact, I was looking at the state numbers last week for June, and at 46 for May, so 46% for May, we were one of the highest in the state. There were a few that were above us, or a couple in the 50% plus range, but there were many, many, many more below 46%, and in fact, there were even some at 0.1%. But their per capita per day usage was significantly below ours, meaning they probably don't have a lot of water to begin with. Communities like Cambria down in the Central Coast, places like that. So you have to look at the per capita per day numbers as well.
Thank you very much. Let's move on to Veolia, please. Welcome, Bernie.
Bernie, how are
you? Yeah. I've got 2 months here. Apologize, I was out last month on vacation. Back east, it was raining every day, so back east gets plenty of rain. So it's out there. Month of May and June, we continue to work with safety in mind.
Not moving. There you go.
Training, normal safety. We did do some electrical training for our staff. OSHA come up with a new electrical standard. Anybody dealing with a control panel, a breaker, a breaker panel, has to have at least a 6 to 8 hour electrical training. Our most staff went through that training last month. So if you have to open a control a panel and change a fuse, you got to have certain gear. So our staff has been trained and geared up for that work. All reports were submitted on time. Water services, 87 million in June and 80 million in May, which is, as Rick mentioned earlier, significant below prior years. You can see the graph here. 2005 or 2015 is the The grain there exists tremendously low in the last couple of years. There's a new slide showing the water reduction, as we stated earlier, 45-46% in May, 40% in June. They do continue to save water. Wastewater, all parameters are met, still doing excellent on the wastewater side. All tests were taken, no issues on the distribution, all lift stations are working properly. Maintenance continued to do what's necessary to maintain the system. Things have seemed to be going fairly well with construction and no major issues. I do have one more slide I'm going to show you. As we're talking about water conservation. This slide here, this is the booster pump station with a water reclaim that was put online the 1st of July. This is showing the water reclaim lines now where we take our effluent water, the number three water, and we reuse it back in the wastewater plant. And we're saving about 46,000 gallons a day. We were using fresh water before, now we're using reclaimed water. And when we run the belt press to desol it, that's about 80,000 gallons a day. So we're looking to save between 50 and 30 million gallons a year now on the freshwater side that we're capturing with the reclaimed water.
Excellent. What's a percentage over, like 15 to 30 million gallons?
That's about 2 to 3%.
2 to 3% of our production.
Every little bit.
Are we full strength?
Full strength.
You sound like a broken record.
Yeah, I know.
Can you please give the board an update on last week's, 2 week before Newport incident? I'm not sure what you're calling it.
Yeah. Last week we had an incident where an ARB that failed. ARB blows the air on the line and the pump kicks on. But this ARB is normally you see them on the side of the road. This one is actually in the middle of the road on the force main. When we lifted up, we couldn't tell. Once we got it open and sucked out, clean, it wasn't ARB that was leaking, so it was not considered SSO. It was just a leaky ARB. And you got a new one to replace that one. As soon as it gets here, it will be taken care of. So it was a minor incident.
I know this is not really your department, but I noticed that they're gone now. How did the shell clean out go so our drains will drain through Discovery Bay? Do we know anything about how that worked out with REC 800?
Well, REC 800 finished their work. I talked to Jeff about this when they finished up, and it was much more extensive than they initially thought it would be.
Like they were there long.
They were hoping to spend about $60,000. They estimate they're into it for over $100,000 at this point in time. They have similar issues down along Clipper, so they're going to be doing some CCTV work down on Clipper to see what happens at that point in time. Other than that, I haven't had any follow up with them.
Okay.
And this again is in your department, but I would notice some of the invoices that we had. I was informed that your accounting department is kind of behind. Do you have any interface with those folks at all?
Behind in which aspect?
Sending us a bill for the work you've done.
No, but I can find out.
Yeah, if you.
Yeah.
We don't like surprises, so you've got to get paid for what you do.
Sure.
So we don't want to have 4 months worth of stuff all the time.
Yeah, I'll follow up.
Thank you.
All right, I got one last thing to report to you on that, on a related subject. Last Monday, I think, at the treatment plant, last Tuesday, at the treatment plant, wastewater treatment plant one, the lagoons for the wetlands, one of the lines broke, and it flooded the, you know where the wetlands are, they're to the north of the oxidation ditch, and just to the north of the peat parcel that we leased out recently. That has caused an issue for our tenant because they can't access the site because of the leak until the site dries up. So I'm just giving you that as a knowledge.
Yes,
yeah. And I will let you know more once I know more.
Do we still have a research project going on out there with Cal?
What was that?
Do we still have a research project going on with Cal out there?
With the Cal Berkeley?
Yeah.
Yes.
Okay.
All right, good deal. We'll move on here. Manager's reports.
I have a request to the board to go dark. In other words, to cancel the second meeting in August the 18th. I will be away and I will be unavailable to put an agenda package together. I will be offline. I will not have internet access. And I won't be back until the following week. I could be back for the board meeting, but I won't have an agenda package to put out for you. And there's also another employee scheduled vacation at the same time that's mission critical to our role. And would like the board, some board consideration of that request.
So that would be just to bypass that meeting and pick it up in September 1st?
We would move whatever we need to move to the August 1st meeting, to the first meeting in August, or to the first meeting in September.
I'm okay with that. You gave the wrong date, though. You said 18th.
August
18th.
August 19th. I'm sorry. I will be. I will be 50 miles buried in a cove in a houseboat up on Lake Powell. So thank you very much.
Maybe you're left in Iraq.
I know.
We could bring the meeting up to you.
Hey, we have a great time.
Yeah, let's go there.
Any other updates?
Not at this point, thank you. And thank you very much for that consideration. I do appreciate it.
Council?
Nothing further for me this evening.
Thank you. All right, any committee updates?
What happened to Steele?
He's great. He's from the HOA meeting.
Oh. Any committees meet this month? All right. No updates on our committees. We'll have meetings later this month. Correspondence here. So we had three correspondents. Okay. Any discussion? All right. Public records request looks like.
Do you know who that was from?
Who was it?
Who?
This was from a competitor of Veolia that wants to get the contract. They know, obviously, that their contract is up, and so they're starting to do their research.
Okay.
Cool.
One of them's got press.
It's American Water.
Anyway.
Any future agenda items? All right, no future agenda. At this time, I'd like to adjourn our regular meeting.
Hey, good job.
Good job.